You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Leonard Lopate today. The concentration of political and economic power by a narrow elite is weakening not only the financial security of ordinary Americans, but the entire economy, writes Robert Kuttner in his new book, The Squandering of America, How the Failure of Our Politics Undermines Our Prosperity. Robert Kuttner is co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, a Boston Globe columnist, a senior fellow of the independent think tank Demos. His book is published by Knopf, and I'm pleased it brings Robert Kuttner to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
In your book, you argue that managed capitalism is better for the economy and more important for democracy than an entirely free market economy. And you do this by highlighting differences between the post-war boom of 1948 to 1973 and the current boom, which started in 1983. What are those differences?
I think the earlier period was a period where the dynamism of the private market, the entrepreneurship, did just fine. We grew at a rate of 3.8% a year for the 25 years after World War II. But it was a period of much greater balance, and there was more social investment. There was a fairer tax system. There were regulatory constraints on financial markets and on other sectors of the economy where systems like electricity or airlines are not naturally competitive, so you regulate them. And it was also a period where labor rights were enforced, so trade unions were stronger. And that period did not have any financial meltdowns. The financial economy played its appropriate role as servant of the real economy, connecting investors with entrepreneurs.
I'm sorry, what do you mean by the real economy?
Well, the real economy is everything other than the financial sector.
Okay.
So it's factories and farms and retail stores and the internet, and it's things other than finance. And economists draw the distinction between the financial economy and the real economy. And you have to locate this historically, because this is a country of individualists. It's a country whose first motto was "Don't tread on me." It's a country that was founded as a rebellion against the British crown. So this is not a country that's had a love affair with big government, although government has played a much bigger role in the history of American development than the mythology often acknowledges. Jefferson set up a land tenure system that prohibited speculators from owning land because he wanted the republic to be a republic of freeholders. And the whole period of development, the 19th century, had a heavy involvement of government. But the most interesting part of the backstory here is the crash of 1929 and the New Deal, because the crash of 1929 discredited the laissez-faire model of capitalism with a big exclamation point. And so in the aftermath of that, the Roosevelt administration built what I call a managed form of capitalism, what the Nobel laureate Paul Samuelson calls a mixed economy, where the private sector does a lot, but the public sector has a major role to play. And then, of course, World War II was a victory not only against the Axis powers, but it was a victory for the idea that government can do great things. And coming out of World War II, this is the period where people who were poor in the Depression graduate into the post-war middle class. They become homeowners. And the GI Bill, FHA loans, college aid, community colleges, public education, all of this is built on public programs to help ordinary people. So there was a period that lasted from the 30s to the early 70s where American capitalism was more balanced than it was before or since.
And when you say balanced, what do you mean by that?
I mean that there's a big role for entrepreneurship, but the tendency of financial markets to go haywire, which is the whole history of crashes and depressions, and the tendency of a market economy to create extremes of wealth and poverty, both of those tendencies were moderated by government's capacity to regulate, government's capacity to, as the saying goes, tax and spend. And socially invest. The system was much more progressive in terms of the tax code that we had. For the average person, tax and spend was a good deal in those years because the tax rate on ordinary people was lower, and the average person got something back. And so what changed in the mid-70s was the politics That's the other point I make in The Squandering of America. There's nothing new about the new economy in the sense that markets have somehow become self-regulating in a way that they weren't before 1929 or before 1973. I went back and I did a lot of research and reading about what went on in the 20s. All kinds of scams went on in the 20s. Financial markets were unregulated. And the details are very complicated. But if you boil it all down, it boiled down to three problems. Too much insider conflicts of interest.
Enron.
Too much non-transparency, corporate books that were cooked, that were misrepresented, and too much leverage, too much borrowing. And as you were hinting in your comment, if you fast forward to what happened in the 90s or what happened in the current decade, it's the same three abuses. Non-transparent financial instruments, to revert to econ speak. What does that mean? It means that you convert a mortgage into a bond, and somehow a mortgage that is distinguished by the fact that the borrower is unlikely to pay it back gets mutated into a AAA security. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing, because some bond rating agency blessed it, and nobody knows what the thing is worth until you have to sell it, because it seldom sells, and turns out it's not worth very much. That's non-transparency. Nobody knew what these things were, what they were worth. The regulators didn't understand it. Even the people who were making money off them didn't understand it. Insider conflicts of interest, they've been endemic. And too much borrowing, that's the essence of derivatives and hedge funds, where the so-called leverage ratio, the ratio of the actual value of the thing to how much money you borrow against it, maybe 10 to 1, 20 to 1, even 50 to 1. So these abuses are timeless, and there's nothing about technology, nothing about the internet, nothing about globalization that changes the risks of the financial market going haywire if you leave it to its own devices.
I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Robert Kuttner. He's the author of The Squandering of America, How the Failure of Our Politics Undermines Our Prosperity. It's published by Knopf. The dismantling of the New Deal, as you mentioned, started in the 70s under Democrat Jimmy Carter, President Jimmy Carter. Deregulation was seen as a way to end stagflation. It worked, didn't it? I mean, then we had the boom of the 80s, the boom that continues today.
This is a very convenient myth. What happened in the 1970s to cause the economy to go into a bout of stagflation? Well, two things happened. First of all, there was the OPEC oil shock. Price of oil is quadrupled, and that was a shock to the system, and that set off a bout of inflation. The Fed then reacts to the bout of inflation by sending interest rates through the roof. That causes higher unemployment. The other thing that happened was that the Bretton Woods system of international financial dealings, where currencies were pegged
to the gold standard?
Well, it was more complicated than that. It was a gold dollar standard, but the dollar was the de facto international currency. That ran out of steam. The rest of the economy was growing too fast. The dollar could no longer play the role of being a currency that was pegged at fixed rates to other currencies without either creating inflation in the U.S. or slowing down the rate of growth globally. Well, those two things caused a period of slower growth. This had very little to do with regulation. I want to repeat that. It had very little to do with regulation, but it was kind of a windfall to right-wing economists, because economists like Milton Friedman, who really hadn't been taken seriously, could say, aha, this is our moment. A regulated form of capitalism failed, you see. It brought us stagflation. And then you had the most conservative Democratic president since Grover Cleveland, Jimmy Carter. Mm-hmm. Alan Greenspan, by the way, in his memoir, who was Gerald Ford's chief economist before he was chairman of the Fed, he takes great offense at the notion that Jimmy Carter started deregulation. He claims credit for doing it. He says it all started under Ford. But it started in the mid-70s. And Carter surrounded himself with fairly conservative economists. And so you get airline deregulation, trucking deregulation, not much standing up for labor's right to organize trade unions. And then, of course, Reagan comes in and puts it all together. And then you have financial deregulation big time. So during the same period, Democrats become more dependent on very wealthy donors on Wall Street. This is the subtitle part of the book.
That hasn't been true in the past. My assumption is that big money always has an undue influence in politics.
There is a tendency in a market economy that's also a political democracy for the power of money to overwhelm the power of votes. But there was a period of 30 or 40 years when the power of mobilized citizens and what John Kenneth Galbraith called countervailing institutions, government itself, organized citizen groups, trade unions, roughly offset the power of big money, particularly in the Democratic Party. But I think by the 80s, when the limits come off of campaign finance and it becomes more and more expensive to run for office, particularly to run for president, Democrats start raising money big time on Wall Street. And this has a very interesting effect. I mean, if you had in this studio your typical Wall Street billionaire liberal, let me tell you what his or her views would be. They would be gay rights, abortion rights, get out of Iraq, deal with global warming, but don't touch financial regulation. Now, it just happens that that recipe...
It reminds me of Michael Bloomberg.
Yeah, exactly.
He's very opposed to... he would like some rollback of Sarbanes-Oxley, which came out of Enron, correct?
Right, and you don't hear much of that anymore, thanks to the subprime meltdown. But that recipe of being quite liberal on social and foreign policy issues and not giving a damn about the average person's economic situation or not giving a damn about having a more balanced form of capitalism itself, that may play very well in Greenwich, may play very well on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. It sure doesn't play well in Southern Ohio, where people are hurting economically and they tend to be socially conservative. And Tom Frank wrote a famous book, What's the Matter with Kansas? I think he was half right. I mean, his story was that your typical working-class American who votes for the Republicans is suffering from a kind of false consciousness. If he knew what was in his interest, he'd vote for the Democrats. It's certainly true that the Republicans are not serving that person's interest. The problem is the Democrats aren't doing all that good a job of serving that person's interest either because of the hammerlock that Wall Street has on the Democratic position on economics, so that you have Robert Rubin, who is both the chairman of Citigroup and the Democrats' guru on economic policy, advising Democratic candidates that the single most important thing for them to do is balance the budget. It's fine to take away the Bush tax cuts, be politically brave about that, but instead of using the money to help ordinary people have some prospect of getting into the middle class or hanging on to their health insurance or hanging on to their retirement coverage or if they lose their job in a factory, get a better job. No, we have to balance the budget. Now, if there's anything worse than tax and spend, it's tax and not spend because people don't see that they're getting anything back for their taxes. So it's another way that there's a kind of downdraft. There's a kind of... having one hand tied behind your back, and that's why people like Sherrod Brown, who won election to the Senate in Ohio by 12 points against a popular moderate incumbent, by running as an economic progressive, he's my hero, and I wish more of the presidential candidates were learning from the six Democrats who took back Republican seats in 06 in the Senate, every one of whom ran as an economic populist.
I'm speaking with Robert Kuttner. He's the author of The Squandering of America, just out from Knopf. We'll have to take a quick break. I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. We'll be right back. This is the Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Leonard, and I'm speaking with Robert Kuttner. He's the author of The Squandering of America, How the Failure of Our Politics Undermines Our Prosperity. Robert, your book focuses a great deal on the deregulation of financial markets. What's the connection between the deregulation on Wall Street and middle America's stagnating wages?
Well, there are a number of connections. Let's take the case of subprime. So here's a case where there's a whole daisy chain that goes from a subprime loan that gets turned by a big Wall Street bank and a bond rating agency into a security. Turns out the gamble goes bad. The big banks lose a ton of money. The Fed has to come to their rescue. What happens next? Well, when the Fed follows a monetary policy that it would not otherwise follow, excuse me, just because it has to bail out Citigroup, the dollar gets weakened, the price of oil goes up, and inflation goes up. So it's not costless to bail out Wall Street. The second problem, and it's a much broader problem, is what I refer to, it's not an original term with me, is financial engineering. If a private equity company borrows money to do a hostile takeover of a corporation, and all of a sudden the corporation, instead of having a normal ratio of equity to debt, has a much higher debt burden, in order to make the kind of returns that private equity likes to make, you have to slash and burn. So you have to cut wages, you get rid of pension funds if you can, you switch to cheaper health plans if you keep the health plan at all, you outsource whatever you can to China. It supercharges the process of creative destruction at the expense of ordinary people in the interest of wise guy insiders. And same deal with hedge funds, so that the more financial engineering takes the place of real entrepreneurship, and these companies, by borrowing all this money, then have to turn around and figure out ruthless cost savings. A lot of those ruthless cost savings are not a case of the managers somehow magically finding more efficient ways to run the company. They're simply a case of the transfer of wealth from employees to middlemen.
But we haven't seen a high employment rate.
You mean a high unemployment
rate? I'm sorry.
Right. Well,
so where is this slash and burn going on? I would think that given that model, we would have high unemployment, consumer confidence would be declining. Consumer confidence is holding pretty steady. We seem to be buying more stuff and have access to more stuff, especially shiny bells and whistles like flat screen TVs,
right,
and iPods. And people today have more equity in their homes in the last 5 to 10 years than their parents saw in their homes in a lifetime. So in some ways, it seems we're doing pretty well.
I think there are three answers to that. First of all, we're generating a lot of jobs, but we're not generating a lot of good jobs. And even though the economy is 18 or 19% more productive than it was in 2000, only – this is an amazing statistic. I refer you to Andrew Sum of the Center for Labor Market Studies at Northeastern University for the documentation of this. 3.4% of Americans have gotten a raise since the year 2000. Oh. The median family has not gotten much of an increase in purchasing power since the 1970s. And if you factor in the fact that the average family is working 500 hours a year more, women entering the workforce in greater numbers than they were in the mid-70s, the median worker has suffered a decline in living standards. Second point, I have a little subsection in The Squandering of America called the Tchotchke Economy. Mm. Now, a tchotchke is a Yiddish word meaning a bauble or a trinket. And the point I make is that the emblem of the new economy might be a 30-year-old with an iPod and a widescreen, flat-screen television not being able to afford an apartment and sharing a $2,000 apartment with three other people. And one of my colleagues read this section, Ezra Klein, who's our wunderkind at the Prospect, and said, you know, it occurs to me that in your 20s, you feel rich because you got all these nifty gadgets. And your 30s, when you're thinking about starting a family and buying a home, you realize that you're poor. And I think that needs to be politicized. One of my colleagues at Demos, Tammy Drought, Tamara Drought, wrote a wonderful book about called Strapped, about the hurdles that 20-somethings and 30-somethings who don't have wealthy parents to pay their tuition or give them the down payment on their first home, the hurdles that younger people face in joining the great American middle class. The third point, I think, in rebuttal to this premise that I would make is that there was a remarkable study that was the subject of a front-page piece in the New York Times about a week and a half ago that revealed the fact that something like 8 or 9% of the disposable income of the average American since the year 2000 has been home equity loans. Hmm. People are treating their houses as a kind of last resort safety net. And you can only do this for so long. And it's not an emblem of people being spendthrifts. It's an emblem of people not making enough money to pay for the basics. So instead of somebody who's 60 years old being able to eventually sell off their home and have a nice cash cushion to retire on, they're having to dip into it during the course of their working life because they don't have a good pension plan, they're not making the income they hope to make. And once that hit a wall, once housing prices ceased rising, this is the first time since the Great Depression that housing prices haven't risen faster than inflation. That game is over. It's going to be a long time before housing is a bonanza. Well, obviously, you can't keep dipping into your equity as a source of purchasing power if your equity is not continuing to increase.
I'm Amy Edding, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Robert Kuttner. He's the author of The Squandering of America, How the Failure of Our Politics Undermines Our Prosperity. You wrote this book before the subprime mortgage market started collapsing. In some ways, you predicted the collapse. Are you happy with the way the Bush administration and the Federal Reserve have responded?
Well, I'm certainly not happy with the way the Bush administration has responded. And in a sense, I wasn't quite as prescient as someone might think because so much of the financial economy was an accident waiting to happen. It could have been subprime that was the first to go. It could have been a hedge fund blowing up. It could have been a run on the dollar. And we haven't even talked about the trade deficit and the dependence on borrowing money, now $1.4 trillion that we've borrowed from the Chinese. This is not a happy position to be in. It's another source of instability. It's the result of a misguided trade policy. But when a big bank like Citigroup, which is one of the three biggest, bets the farm on subprime and the bet goes bad, the Fed can't just stand idly by and let 1929 happen again. I think the difference between now and 1929, even though there are lots of similarities in the kinds of financial abuses, is that the Fed is much more proactive, much more sophisticated, and is not going to let a big bank getting into difficulty take down the whole system. Now, as I said before, that's not costless. When the Fed responds to this kind of a crisis by cheapening money, you're courting inflation, you're weakening the dollar, you're leading to a higher price of gasoline at the pump. But the only silver lining is that a financial panic is not going to turn into a Great Depression. However, I think if you're going to bail these guys out after the fact, you have an obligation to pursue preventive policies before the fact so that they don't get into so much difficulty gambling with other people's money and you don't have so many bailouts. I recently reviewed Alan Greenspan's memoir, The Age of Turbulence. And what I found absolutely charming about it was that half of the book is a kind of a screed against regulation. It's three cheers for the proposition that the economy is self-regulating, markets don't need government, derivatives are wonderful, regulators keep your mitts off of financial markets. And the other half is a memoir on all the times that he used the Fed to bail out financial markets, almost as if it slipped his mind that the Fed is part of the government. So either the economy is self-regulating or it isn't. If it is self-regulating and it makes a mistake, then let it suffer the consequences, which unfortunately would be too high a penalty for the rest of us. Or if it isn't self-regulating, let's be intellectually honest about that and have some consumer protections.
What kind of regulations do you think the Fed should be pursuing?
Well, I'll give you one example. The Fed has had authority since 1994 when Congress, in a rare bout of regulation, passed an anti-predatory lending act mandating the Fed to issue lending standards for mortgage companies that were not otherwise federally regulated. And Greenspan, because he did not believe in this philosophically or ideologically, refused to issue the rules. And only now, 6 months after the subprime crisis hit the fan, is Bernanke finally getting around to issuing some rules under pressure from Congress. That's, this is not Monday morning quarterbacking. Smart people in Congress saw this coming 13 years ago.
13 years ago. That's amazing. Why is the regulation of the financial markets not being talked about on the 2008 presidential campaign trail? If there's such a connection between Wall Street and my pocketbook, why aren't candidates talking about that? Is it not sexy enough? Is it too complicated?
Because the big dogs have too much political power. So, and this is a little bit of inside baseball, but there's a fight going on right now about who is going to be appointed to the two Democratic seats on the Securities and Exchange Commission. Hugely consequential issue. Do we follow the road of more deregulation, or do we reverse course and do some regulation? And the two senior Democrats who get to decide this are Chuck Schumer, liberal on every other issue, close friend of Wall Street, who's the head of the Securities Subcommittee in the Senate Banking Committee, and Chris Dodd, who's the head of the committee, both of whom are kind of center-right on issues where Wall Street cares about whether it gets regulated. So the two Democratic seats are unlikely to be taken by people who are vigorous regulators. And two other examples. Should hedge fund windfall bonuses be taxed at a very low rate, or should they be taxed as ordinary income? Congress doesn't have the votes to tax them as ordinary income, so that some hedge fund manager who makes $1 billion is being taxed at a lower rate than his secretary. Why? Because Democrats as well as Republicans have to raise their money from these guys. And worst of all, Barney Frank got a pretty good bill. He's the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, out of committee, onto the House floor, doing a degree of re-regulation of subprime mortgages. The bill got watered down and gutted on the House floor. Why?
Even in the midst of this subprime mortgage meltdown.
And even in the midst of the meltdown. In fact, the other day, listeners may recall that the New York Times, on a Monday, praised Barney Frank for superintending this tough bill. On Tuesday, the editorial said, it turns out he's a wuss. He's a wimp. The bill is terrible. Well, it wasn't that Barney changed his mind. What happened between the 2 days, the 24 hours between the two editorials, is that the lobbyists for the mortgage banking industry got to enough members of his committee to weaken the bill, so that at the very moment of their disgrace, they still have the power, when you do it as inside baseball, to turn enough votes in Congress. And that's because your average bear, Republican or Democrat, looks to very rich people to raise campaign money. This is not rocket science. He who pays the piper calls the tune.
It sounds like the antidote to this is average Americans stepping up and electing people who follow through on their concerns. You say virtually every Democrat who took the seat of an incumbent Republican in the 2006 midterm election ran as an economic populist. You see this as a sign of hope. And yet, John Edwards is running as a populist, and he's trailing fellow Democrat Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama in the polls. Why isn't his message getting more traction?
I think two reasons. I think, first of all, the messenger is as important as the message. And leadership is a difficult to define quality. I think Edwards sometimes comes across as a populist. Frankly, just between you and me and our listeners, I think sometimes he comes across as a used car salesman. He comes across as too slick, which reins on his message. And also, he's disadvantaged financially. Hillary's raising money on Wall Street. Obama's raising money on Wall Street. Edwards isn't. So Edwards has had to choose between contesting all of the early primaries or betting the whole farm on Iowa, because he doesn't have enough money to do both things. So he's put all of his resources into Iowa in the hope that if he wins Iowa, he becomes a giant killer and he gets momentum. I think it's a long shot. And finally, I actually said this to Edwards, I think Edwards is so committed to dealing with poverty that he sometimes overlooks the fact that it isn't just the bottom 15% of the electorate, which is not a majority. It's the bottom 70 or 80% of the electorate that needs a champion, that is vulnerable economically. And the fact that people like Sherrod Brown in Ohio or John Tester in Montana or Jim Webb in Virginia or Claire McCaskill in Missouri make this good politics in states that vote more often for Republicans than Democrats shows that you can do this anywhere in the country, but it's harder to do it at the presidential level because presidential candidates are so reliant on big money.
This is pretty demoralizing. What hope do you have for politics to do a better job at addressing these financial issues? Does it start with more campaign finance regulation?
No, I think it ends with more campaign finance regulation because the Supreme Court has made it very clear that they're not going to allow serious campaign finance regulation anytime soon. But I think the victories of people at the state level who take these progressive positions show that if you mobilize people, the power of people can actually be more potent than the power of money. And I think events are going to force Democrats to be more proactive. The subprime crisis is not over. Grenades are going to be going off in the financial economy all year during the presidential year. And I think that's going to push politics in a more proactive direction. I mean, Roosevelt, after all, ran on a platform to balance the budget. And when he got elected, he realized that that would not be exactly smart. So I think events change very rapidly in America, thank God. I mean, who would have thought in 1958 that by 1964 you would have a president of the United States declaring on television, "We shall overcome." And events can drive leaders. Events can make leaders. So I think you need organizing at the base. I think you need leadership from the top. And I think we may yet get that.
I've been speaking with Robert Kuttner. He's the author of The Squandering of America, just out from Knopf. Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you for having me.